Today on Basic, from the very first season of MTV's The Real World, Kevin Powell.
When I think back on it now, it was the explosion of what we call Generation X. We were in Soho at the corner of Prince and Broadway in a loft space. It was dope. There's so much stuff that happened in 1992. Bill Clinton gets elected president. The Los Angeles riots happened that year. When we had that argument, people say it's the most famous argument in American TV history. Branding, marketing, having endorsement deals. We couldn't have imagined that kind of stuff. You could become a billionaire off of this, or you could become president of the United States.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to Basic, the official podcast of the unofficial history of cable television. I'm former TV executive Doug Herzog, and today Jen and I stop being polite and start getting real.
And I'm Jen Chaney, TV critic for Vulture and New York Magazine, and I am never polite, but I am always real.
She is indeed. Well, Jen, today we're going to talk to Kevin Powell from the very first season of The Real World, which debuted on MTV 30 years ago. Do you recall seeing the show for the first time?
You know, I don't remember seeing it for the first time so much as I remember watching it recently, so that I could prepare to watch The Real World Homecoming. And it was just like, it doesn't feel like it was 30 years ago until you start watching it and realize how everyone was dressing and what we were doing back then. And it seems like possibly 60 years ago, actually.
And no one was on their cell phone.
Nope.
So anyway, Kevin went on to become a noted author, activist, and has some pretty vivid memories of that inaugural season. And of course, The Real World started the reality television revolution that continues to this day.
Doug and I will be back after the interview to discuss The Real World further. But first, let's get real with Kevin Powell.
Welcome, Kevin Powell, to Basic. We are so happy to have you.
It's my honor to be here. Thank you so much, Brother Doug. I mean, we go back, what, 30
years? We go back. But all right. So speaking of going back, Kevin, the first question that we pose to everybody who comes on this podcast is, do you remember when you first got or saw a cable? And what were you excited to watch?
Wow. You know what? I was thinking about that question. For me, I think it was literally when I got on The Real World. I was like, oh, God, I got to get cable so I could actually watch the show. That's how it happened. Now that I think about it. Because remember, I was a young writer. It's not like I had a lot of money. And so, cable was still kind of a luxury for a lot of us back then, if you guys remember, you know, when you think about the early days of it. But obviously, I paid attention. And what I remember in college, we would see all the videos that were on MTV and BET, but it felt like it was either in our student center or it was like in one person might have had it in their dorm room. But most of us, most of my college years, I was literally away from TV other than watching from someone else's TV. Now that I think about it, I never thought about this, Doug. That's a good question.
That's why we're here, Kevin.
Wow.
So as you said, Kevin, you were a writer when the Real World opportunity came up. And, you know, younger folks may not remember, but the concept of reality TV as a genre really didn't exist. So the idea of being on a show like The Real World was, I would imagine, sounded like a strange opportunity. What was your reaction to the concept of this?
Well, you know, it's a great question. What I remember is that I moved to New York in 1990. I was dirt young, and I was writing. I was freelance writing for like Interview Magazine, Rolling Stone, Thrasher, the skateboard magazine, which seems to have been around forever. I was doing like, you know, news stuff for like the Amsterdam News up in Harlem. And I was also writing bios for artists. Like I wrote Usher's first bio. I wrote TLC's first bio. Little did I know they would become Usher and TLC, like these big group, big musical acts. But I was with a group from Sony Records called Joe Public. They were an R&B band. You might remember them, Doug. They were out of Buffalo, New York. And, you know, when you look at the early 90s, I mean, we had bright clothes, bright baggy clothes. You know, my hair was wild. My mom's thought I was on drugs because of my hair. It's cool.
Was Joe Public, would they have been considered like New Jack Swing style?
They were New Jack Swing. Exactly. So that's that whole era. And we went to a restaurant in Times Square, which I'm sure you remember. Anyone from New York remember Stardust Cafe. That's what it was called. And when I went in there with them, we all were dressed the same. I remember wearing overalls and whole nine. And then a young woman named Tracy Fiss came up to the table, Doug, Tracy Fiss, and said she was with MTV and they were working on a show called The Real World. And she actually went, bam, the card said MTV and it said The Real World. She actually had a card. And said casting. And I was like, huh. And what I remember thinking was like, you know, I was focused on my writing career. I was very involved in the poetry scene, the New York Poets Cafe, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, writing. And literally thought to myself, well, maybe if I ended up on TV, maybe I can get some speaking gigs. I can actually have some extra money, because I was really wondering, like, how was I going to survive in New York City as a writer? And that's how it happened. That's literally how it began. Was it you that greenlit it, Doug? You greenlit the show. Is that right? Did you?
The Real World?
Yeah,
I did. Yeah, I did. Oh, yeah. Yeah. We were. Yeah, that's a story for another podcast. But yes, yeah, I did. And so wait. So let's get back to you. So did you go in an audition like after you got the card?
Oh my God, it was so funny. So I got the card, and she said, "You got to make a video of yourself." I had no camera. I was like, "Okay, what do I do?" I had a friend who had one of those gigantic camcorders, like you put on your shoulder, literally. And it's funny because when you think about it now, we have our cell phones, Androids, iPhones, you can shoot anything. Like I'm literally editing a film with my team right now where we shot stuff on laptops and cell phones over the last 2 years. I couldn't even imagine that in 1991, 92. So I made a video just describing who I was and what I was into. I was definitely a hip hop kid at the time. I was a house music kid. Y'all remember that was the explosion of grunge. I'm a huge Nirvana fan. I love Kurt Cobain and Pearl Jam and all of that. You know, was it before Beverly Hills 90210?
No.
It came after.
It was going on.
It was on TV. But Friends came after us. Friends came after us.
Friends after, and maybe Melrose Place or something.
That's right.
Melrose Place was on.
Oh, it was already on.
Well, sorry, I know my 90210 history very well.
Oh my god, that is funny.
I heart Dylan, Jen.
Of course.
So I sent the tape in, and then I got called in to meet John Murray. And I remember the only question I remember, which is really funny when I think about it. He says, "So what do you think about sex?" And I just was like, "Well, it's great, right? Isn't it great?" Or something like that. I can't remember anything else he asked me.
Why did he ask you what your feelings about sex were? Was he trying to gauge whether you would like hook up with your roommates? What was that about?
Well, you know, that's a great question, because think about it. It was Mary Ellis Bynum, who had the soap opera background, and John Murray, who had the news documentary background, and they had come together as partners to create this concept of reality TV. And think about, you know, as a kid, what I remember was watching when I was with babysitters, General Hospital, American, what was the show? All My Children and General Hospital. Jenny and Greg. And it was all that drama happening. You know what I mean? And so I'm not sure if they were hoping for it, but I just think they wanted to get a sense of our personalities. And mm-hmm. We were definitely seven very different kinds of human beings. And we still are to this day.
What did you think of MTV around that time? Like, what were your thoughts about MTV? Like, you know, as you were coming into the Real World, were you watching anything on the network at that point?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, yeah, you know, so we're talking about the golden era of hip hop. And so by that point, like 91, 92, hip hop had exploded, you know, because of my gosh, what do you say? NWA, Public Enemy, Queen Latifah, MC Light, you know, even MC Hammer and Vanilla Ice. It was just everywhere. And MTV was definitely a big part of that. You know, Yum TV Raps, if I remember, Doug, became like one of the biggest shows on the network. You know what I'm saying?
1,000%.
But I think back on it now, it was the explosion of what we call Generation X. It was really like bubbling. You mentioned it, Jen. It's like you got Melrose Place, Beverly Hills 90210. You got all these different things happening. And then along comes, you know, grunge is happening. Hip hop is happening. And then along comes The Real World, which was very much a part, we realize now, a defining moment of our generation. Who knew? Mm-hmm. Who knew?
Yeah, it was that brief 5-year period when people actually cared about us and talked about us. And then it all went away.
it was back to us boomers.
You're right, Jen. We had our moment, and then came the millennials. And boy, did they come on. It's almost like we're forgotten by a lot of people, which is why I think The Real World is actually important as a time capsule. Because like, hey, we were here. We did a lot of incredible stuff, and a lot of things that exist today wouldn't exist if it wasn't for boomers, Doug. Shout out to Doug, and for Gen X people.
You mentioned that you came back from being overseas, and it sounds like you were just immediately jumping into shooting the show.
Yeah.
What do you remember about meeting your fellow roommates and just kind of being in that loft for the first time?
I thought I won a game show prize. It felt like I had been on The Price is Right or all the game shows I grew up watching. It was an amazing space. I mean, look, we were in Soho at the corner of Prince and Broadway in a loft space. It was dope. It was exciting. It was all kinds of cool art. And it's you can't make this stuff up. You know, it's like one of those, you know, it's funny. I used to say to myself years later, I felt like I was Forrest Gump in a certain kind of way. Like, how do you end up in these places? And, you know, not knowing. I mean, think about it. The year that we did our show, Bill Clinton gets elected president. It's kind of a shifting of America politically. You know, the Los Angeles riots happened that year. There's so much stuff that happened in 1992. And we're literally a part of that capsule. And I was like, wow, you know, and then, you know, you're meeting Becky, Eric, Andre, Norman, Julie, I mean, all, Gouda, Smokey, Gouda the dog, Smokey the cat. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. It's just, the thing that's touched my heart the most, Jen, is that in the last year, I was sharing this with Doug when we were texting, it's like I get a lot of messages, and make it clear, Doug, and everyone, most of it is overwhelmingly positive. I need to say that, but it's just like, because we didn't have social media in 1992, we didn't even have email, as far as I can remember, in 1992. When we did the reunion episodes last year, which is still streaming now on Paramount Plus, I'm sure they would want me to say that on Paramount Plus. You know what I mean? I've learned well, Doug, on Paramount Plus. You know, all these people have said, I was 10 years old, I was 13 years old, I was 20 years old when I watched this show, and this is what it meant to me.
One of the big kind of storylines in that first season were some of the debates that you had with Julie and with Becky about race, and that became kind of a real touch point for that show. For that season, I should say.
How about, I think for that era.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. Absolutely. There was a whole situation where you and Julie got into an argument. Julie claims that you had like tried to hit her with like a candlestick holder or something. And you said that didn't happen. And there was an entire argument that then ensued around that and around the assumptions that people were making. But why was there no footage of whatever it was that actually happened?
Because it never actually happened.
Oh, really?
No, it never actually happened.
I mean, oh man, this is breaking news for me.
No, I mean, you know, it made for great TV. I mean, look, when we had that argument, the famous one, and people say it's the most famous argument about race in reality TV show history. I think it's the most famous argument, period, in TV, American TV history. I mean, we were literally outside, just us. We had no idea, and the camera crew. We had no idea there was a crowd around us eventually. Because we were that passionate about what we felt at the time, you know, whatever it was. And it's just, it wasn't scripted. I mean, it was just who we were organically in that moment. You know, I had my positions that she had hers, Julie, I'm speaking about. And little did we know it would become this kind of compelling TV. Because, I mean, think about it. If we, you know, we're all TV kids, at least I was growing up. And it's like, you didn't see that kind of stuff on television. You didn't see it, you know, and this is before Fox News Channel and everything else that we've seen in the last 10, 15, 20 years. And so you didn't see that kind of debate happening, quote unquote.
Not at all.
I think it blew people's minds, you know, and the fact that it was on MTV. I think it also spoke, Doug, to the cutting edge nature of MTV at that time, because you all were pushing a lot of envelopes, and this certainly did it in that way. And it wasn't just the conversations, the heated debates about race. The fact that Norman as the first openly gay person on TV, American TV, is a historical moment, you know? So that's another thing that we have to think about. Like we were literally breaking barriers with that first season, you know, and in ways that we couldn't have imagined and, you know, what it would mean to people. I mean, literally just like I've had a lot of people the last year say to me, you know, I never thought about race or racism until I watched your season of The Real World back in the 90s. The same thing, you know, Norman told me that it was okay for me to be lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, non-binary, non-gender conforming. That's really important. And so I also think that, you know, for me, it took me some time to understand that, yeah, it's pop culture, but pop culture can actually be a very, very compelling way to educate people, you know.
To that point, Kevin, you know, when you went into the house and you started this whole process, I got to think it was hard to really understand what the show was going to be, what the impact was going to be, what was going to happen to your lives coming out of it, because there was no precedent for it. So, for instance, when you're on the street corner and you're in this intense conversation with Julie, I mean, did you have any sense when it would, you know, like, oh my God, like that's going to be on TV one day. Millions of people are actually going to hear what she said and what I said. And what did that all mean? Or were you just in the moment and didn't realize where this was all going?
I was in the moment. You all understand, like I was at Rutgers for 4 years, and that was the Reagan Bush years. It was really intense. You know, I got my wokeness during that time because of the anti-apartheid movement. Nelson Mandela was in jail. So I had already been through a lot of really intense stuff, and I really had no clue. And I mean, I can laugh about it now, but I'll tell you straight up, later, I got my mom cable. My mom is not into cable, nothing, like not really. She's mad old school, and she's, you know. And so, but I got her cable, and I realized the impact of what was happening when she called me, because she was horrified at the way, quote unquote, I had talked to the white women on the show. And think about where my mother's from. She's a Black woman from South Carolina, born during the Jim Crow era. And what her residual memory was, that Black men got lynched for stuff like that. I just want you all to think about that for a second. And so think about the impact of that. And so it was deep. It was deep. We didn't know. We had no idea. You know, I wasn't thinking like, oh, my God, people are going to label me a certain kind of way. Or, oh, my God, you know, people are going to come after Becky or Julie or any of us in a certain kind of way. We were simply trying to be ourselves because, again, we didn't have the benefit of watching a season of reality TV before ours. After us, people saw, oh, this is what can happen. I mean, trust me. Jen, Doug, everyone, when I watch stuff now, like the Kardashians, I mean, branding, marketing, having endorsement deals, we couldn't have imagined that kind of stuff. You could become a millionaire off of you could become a billionaire off of this, or you could become president of the United States.
That's what makes that first season so incredibly special. First of all, just, you know, an amazing group of people, amazing stories, real drama and conflict, the kind you couldn't, you know, ever really script or makeup. And you all came into it with, you know, zero expectations, which is the biggest difference between you and every other cast that followed you who came in with expectations.
I mean, if I can say this, I think this is important. Think about that season. We're talking about Julie, Becky, Heather. I forgot Heather B. How could I forget Heather B? Norman, Andre, Eric, and myself. Think about where we are 30 years later, you know, don't say gay bills in places like Florida. That's Norman, you know, Black Lives Matter, the conversations that we had, you know, the Me Too movement, all these different things that have come forth, you know, Julie's dealing with the issue of homelessness. And we've seen this explosion of homelessness in California, New York, all over the country in a way we couldn't even imagine back then. All of that was in our original 13 episodes just because we were being who we were. And I'm not saying that we were the best cast or anything like that. It was just, we were organically who we were. We believed in what we believed in. And little did we know that it would actually be a snapshot of our country.
Right. I mean, you couldn't do this again now or even again back then after it had been done the first time for the reasons Doug just said, is that people knew what the real world was.
Yeah.
But certainly now, like, people are just too aware that they could be captured on camera at any moment, even if they were having an argument on the street and they weren't being followed by an actual film crew. So,
well, I've said this a million times. I am the idiot who was actually walking around the halls of MTV after the first season saying, I don't think we can do this again, because if we do it again, then the next group of kids is going to come in and they're going to have all these expectations about what's going to happen to them. And they're going to be incredibly self-conscious and kind of insufferable and over the top trying to get noticed, and nobody's going to watch. And I couldn't have been more wrong, because they were over the top with all those expectations and incredibly insufferable. Everybody wanted to watch all the time for 25 years. And so, I mean, Doug, I was dead wrong.
And Doug, on top of that, I mean, you know, think about it. The real world that season foreshadowed TikTok, Snapchat, Instagram Live. I draw
a straight line from the real world to social media.
Isn't it something?
There's no question about it. I mean, you know, having the cameras turned, you know, when that generation got the opportunity to turn the cameras on themselves, it's just something you never put the genie back in the bottle.
No, and it's deep, because do you all remember that movie with Jim Carrey in the late 90s, The Truman Show? Remember that movie?
Oh, yeah. I love that movie.
Yeah, me too. And I was like, wow, is this what we're going to become? And it still wasn't that far along, but because we still were in the beginning stages. I feel like the dot-com thing exploded somewhere, mid to late 90s. We couldn't imagine. I mean, I literally have friends who are influencers just off the Instagram. I'm like, how did this happen? Well, the real world. That's how it's happening.
the real world gets blamed for almost everything, you know.
Basically. But I won't take credit for Donald Trump. Please don't put that. Don't throw that on the seven of us, please.
So I want to come back to what we're talking about with the Julie argument. And obviously the argument itself was real, even if the instigation of the argument wasn't necessarily real. But I'm wondering, like, were you given scenarios like that and then you had to respond to them? If that was the case, like, did you feel like you were being cast sort of in a role as like, I have to be, you
know? No, absolutely not. You know, I was never even asked about my politics, honestly. That never came up in the conversation. Now, John Murray actually said to me through the years, you know, I had no idea, you know, what your politics were. I was never asked. The only thing I can say as an African-American person, as an African-American male, I was very well aware of stereotypes of my community. So I knew that I wasn't going to go in there, as we often say in the Black community, shuffling and jiving and just being coonish or buffoonish. I was very sensitive to that. I was very clear about that because I did feel I had a responsibility. Remember, again, I had become a student leader, a youth leader in college. And so I was very aware of history in that way. But I wasn't even thinking about arguments. Things simply came up and go back again, I was the oldest of the castmates. I had already gone through 4 years of college, and my 4 years were very intense because it's like it's era of AIDS, crack, Reagan, Bush. It was a lot of stuff that was going on that was in my head. You know what I mean? And so it just some came out, and then literally, and Doug remembers this, as we were taping, you know, we taped from February to May of 1992, April 29th, LA explodes in the middle of all of that. And we're literally watching that happen as we're taping the show. So there's no way you could not talk about racial stuff at that time.
I mean, I went back and watched that whole first season prior to your reunion show because wow. I was writing about the reunion show. And it was amazing how relevant it all still was this many years later. And the fact that, you know, so much of what you were saying really applied to the moment that we were having in 2020. It was incredible.
It's deep. You know, I mean, it's interesting you said it because one of the first calls I got when the whole George Floyd thing exploded in May of 2020 was from my brother Norman, who I love dearly, from my cast. And he said, I just want to apologize to you, you know, because I didn't understand a lot of things back then. And it was deep. And I mean, and I said to Norman, well, I thank you because of you, I'm a straight ally to this day, you know. And so I think that we learned from each other. And my hope is from that experience, if nothing else, people saw that, yeah, we may come from different backgrounds. And as we know, over the course of the many seasons of The Real World, you know, you saw folks were not just white and black, but also Latinx, Asian, different identities, different cultures, et cetera, that there's, you know, there's going to be debate, there's going to be controversy, there's going to be arguments. But the hope is, at least from our season, that there's some way that we can learn from this stuff and share with each other. That's the hope, you know, and it forced me to grow and think about things because I also believe, you know, that there's ways that we can communicate with each other as Americans, which is why these podcasts like your podcast is so important because, yeah, we're talking about pop culture. We're talking about music. We're talking about sports, things like that. But we realize those are ways that get people to talk with each other at first, and then hopefully get to the deeper stuff. Like I'm sitting here as I'm thinking about what you're saying. I'm thinking about, you know, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson being the first Black woman to go up to be a Supreme Court justice, and hopefully she'll get, you know, in. But just this fact that it's taken over 200 years, the fact that we're in Women's History Month and we still have only had about four, maybe, women on the Supreme Court in over 200 years. And so these are the conversations that have come because of things like The Real World. I believe, like, where are we as a society and where do we need to still go? You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. Hey, I'm gonna take a complete left turn and take it back to something a little more off topic. Did you have a girlfriend at this point, Kevin? Wasn't she on the show at some point? How'd you navigate all that?
Her name was Cassini, and she thought I was crazy because I was doing the show. And, you know, honestly, I talked her into being on it, and I talked my mom into, I had my mother, Cassini agree, you know, that relationship, I don't even know if the relationship lasted the taping of the show, if I'm honest about it, and that's bad to say. I feel really bad that I don't remember. I mean, I was young, and then I also talked my mom into letting the camera crew come to her house in Jersey City, my hometown, and she was so pissed because one of the camera people put their camera on her dining room table. You do not put your camera on mom's dining room table. You just don't do that. You know what I mean? Like, it was funny, but I, you know, I was hustling. I was trying to, because also 92, keep in mind that Quincy Jones, the legendary Quincy Jones, had partnered with Time Inc. and was starting this thing called Vibe Magazine. And I was literally writing the first cover story for the first issue. What was the big song in 92? You know, outside of Nirvana, it was Naughty by Nature, OPP. Tretch from Naughty by Nature was on the cover.
Also Jersey, Newark, repping Newark.
Yeah, that's right. Jersey in the house. And it's like, you know, so there was a lot of stuff going on. I was teaching a part-time at New York University. Julie and Heather B. had come to my class, you know. And so, and Jen, to your question, like, yeah, those arguments are things that people remember. But like when we were doing the reunion episode, I forgot that we had water gun fights. I forgot that Julie and Heather had come to my class. I forgot that I had done a poetry reading at the New Eureka and they came to that. I forgot about Andres performing and Becky performing. There's a lot of stuff that happened. But, you know, I mean, people remember Norman was gay and Kevin and these folks had arguments and Eric was the stud. And it's like, and Becky, I mean, not Becky, Heather punched somebody at Kevin and Eric's birthday party. That's the stuff that they remember. You know, it is what it is, but it's
now you just dropped something in there, which should not necessarily be overlooked, which was taking the cast to the poetry slam.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was probably the first time anything like that was seen on television.
You know, and it's funny you say that, Doug, because like I didn't think about it when we did it. But sure enough, as you know, MTV and HBO eventually started showing poetry because of you know, I think because of the real world, honestly, because of the real world.
Well, and, no question about it. I mean, that was literally, I think, the first time it had ever gotten, you know, it was a thing, you know, downtown New York, but it wasn't on national TV.
That's right. You know, and it's funny you said that because Bob Holman, who's my brother to this day, who's running the New York Post Cafe, was thrilled that we brought the cameras there. And, you know, something else that's important, a pop culture moment, like, you know, within a year, I'm on staff at Vibe magazine, and I was so excited about the opportunity. I met Tupac Shakur in August of 1993, and little did I know, I was a fan of his because of his music, but also because of his signature role in Juice, and he had been watching The Real World. That's how. Wow.
We're gonna want to get back to Tupac before we're done, but okay, we got a couple more basic cable questions for you.
Okay.
So as you were saying, when you were filming this, obviously you had no idea what it was going to turn out to be, but was there a point once The Real World had started airing that you were like, oh, wow, people are really watching this?
I'm laughing because there's a couple of moments that are really, really funny because I don't consider myself a celebrity. But the first one was I was in L.A., where I'm at now. I was at the, is the Mondrian Hotel still here? The Mondrian Hotel in Sunset, you know, Boulevard. It was a famous hotel back in the 90s.
That was it. That was the place, man.
It was. I was standing out there with James Bernard from The Source magazine. Shout out to James Bernard. And of all people, LL Cool J. And a group of women came by and they started screaming. And naturally, I'm thinking, I'm like a buck 145 pounds, 150 pounds. I'm some puny dude. I'm like, they must be screaming for LL Cool. It's LL Cool J. It's LL Cool J. They were like, Kevin. I was like, holy cow, this is not real. You're going to bypass the muscular sex symbol dude, LL Cool J, and come to me. Literally, I'm not making this up. That happened. I was in shock. And the other thing was when the seven of us were invited to the VMAs, Doug, in LA in September 92. And they told us.
Was that still in the Arsenio Hall era?
That was the Arsenio Hall era. And at that VMAs was Red Hot Chili Peppers, Nirvana, Howard Stern, a whole.
Oh, that bunch. Was at UCLA at the Boley Pavilion.
Yeah, exactly. And they screamed for the seven of us as if we were the Beatles. It was hilarious. It was hilarious. And that's when I realized people actually watched this. And I think, honestly, Doug and Jen and everyone, what started it is the concept is now very popular. Like, what do we call it? Marathons? Marathons. I feel like that summer of 92, like we've showed the 13 episodes and then MTV made the brilliant decision to show it in marathon form.
You know what, Kevin? You are absolutely, I totally forgot about that. The show actually took off pretty quick. But I remember that first when the season ended, we did a weekend and we just kept on running them back to back. And that's where it kind of really went crazy.
It blew up. And all of a sudden we were like, holy cow. What I remember, Jen, is people telling us from MTV, like the PR people, just be careful of going to malls. We're like, really? We can't go to the mall? It was huge.
Dude, you know what you invented with those marathons?
What's that?
Binging. Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Ben, you're right. You're right.
Everybody thinks Netflix invented it, but hey, guess what? It was around for a long time.
Basic cable. Thank you, basic cable.
I'm loving this interview because, you know, you're making me. And I think that season in particular is not given enough credit for so many different things. So many. Wow. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask a couple questions about the reunion show, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Which I thought was really, really well done. But I'm wondering, you all ended up taping that during COVID. Was it originally supposed to be taped earlier and then it got pushed back, or was that always when it was gonna happen?
No. You know, honestly, so just so you all know, like people always ask if we the seven of us had stayed in touch via a text thread for the last couple of years. And you'll appreciate this, brother Doug. Rob Fox, one of our directors for our season, had died.
The dearly departed.
Yeah, dearly departed. And I mean, I love Rob. Let me tell you, if I can take a detour for a second. When we were doing our season of The Real World, it was Rob who actually said to me as we were watching the LA riot unfold on TV, would I be interested in hosting a documentary for MTV, which we eventually did called Straight from the Hood, as you remember, Doug, that won a whole bunch of awards. It was a really incredible experience, but it was Rob's vision. And, and so when Rob died, I just reached out and I said, look, we all have a unique life experience. It's kind of like, no one can say we're the original seven. No one can say they were really before us. And so we need to stay in touch because God forbid any of us pass. And so we had talked loosely about doing something together around a documentary form. I had, talked to John Murray a couple of times and George Vashore, who Doug knows, who was part of the production of the Real World.
Key member of the creative crew.
Yeah, love. Shout out to George for sure. You know, very important name there in addition to Buna Murray. And then we got a call in December, Jen, of 2020, saying that they are going to do it. And we wanted to do it really right away. We're like, holy cow. And so the seven of us talked with each other. You know, we worked through all the feelings, emotions, yada, yada, yada. And we agreed. And we had no idea that we were going to go back to the original loft. And just by fate, Jen, the loft was on sale. So we had exactly 1 week to get in there and film our episodes of the reunion before it was bought. And it was really an incredible kind of coming back. You know, plus it was COVID. And up until that point, we didn't have any vaccination by that point at the time. There was no vaccine. No. And so we all kept getting tested. I can say it now. Julie and Andre had already had COVID before then. And thank God they were okay. And their families are okay. And as you all know, Eric ended up getting COVID right before we started. And so he couldn't even be there physically with us. But it was profound, the whole thing, because you're dealing with the emotions of 30 years before, you're dealing with us coming together for the first time like this. Some of us hadn't seen each other. It's just the 90s. And then you're in the middle of a freaking global pandemic. You can't make this stuff up.
So again, with the reunion, I mean, you're coming to do that. It's, if I'm not mistaken, it's like right after George Floyd, right? If I'm not getting my dates mixed up.
Well, we came together in January of 2021. So it's about half a year after Floyd. Yeah.
Shortly after.
Yeah.
It seemed to me that it was obvious that they were going to have you kind of revisit a lot of the conversations that you had in the original one. And yet when that eventually did happen, you know, the way things went down with Becky, I ended up writing an entire piece about just that, because I thought the way that she responded to you and the conversation that you guys had was something that every white person needed to watch because of her defensiveness. And I don't know. I just thought that was a really incredible conversation. I'm just wondering, A, how it felt for you. And then B, have you guys reconnected at all since that happened?
It was a great question. And I'm really loving and appreciating the questions. This is a wonderful conversation. And thank y'all for having me again. I just need to say that. No, we didn't know. We kind of talked amongst each other, if I'm going to be honest about it. Like, we wanted to come there, you know, peace and love, honestly. Like, you know, we weren't trying to create anything, honestly. We were just like, let's just do this. You know, it's a cool way to talk about what we've been doing since then. People had projects going on, yada, yada, yada. And honestly, for me personally, like, since the original Real World, I've been blessed to visit all 50 states in this country, 5 to 7 continents. I've evolved, you know, to the point where obviously I'm still anti-racism, but I've also become a pro-feminist man. I've become a straight ally, as I said. I've become someone who talks about all forms of oppression, marginalization. And I mean, I really do truly love all people. And I'm speaking now as an activist, as a leader. That's very important for me to say. That's what I've evolved into. And so that was where my heart was at. And I also, over time, started speaking differently. You know what I mean? It's just like, you know, I don't yell and curse at people. That was when I was in my 20s. You know what I'm saying? That's not who I am at this point. So no, we didn't know. I knew that they were going to show clips. They said we're going to show some clips and just to see where people are. But I was actually very surprised by the reactions. That's what started the whole thing. And then, as you know, Jen, and thank you for that piece, by the way. I did read that piece that you wrote, and I appreciate you, because I read a lot of the stuff that during that time. I think it was interesting to see all the feelings that came out. It was sad, because I think, you know, it would be like, it's like if you see, you know, racism or sexism or homophobia or anti-Semitism, whatever it is happening, and you still run into that house that is burning with that, you gotta really think about where you are. And it was really sad that there was such a blind spot there, you know what I mean, mm-hmm. to not understand mm-hmm. some basic things. And, you know, she cut herself off from us, to be honest with you, you know, and that part is sad. And then we were trying to help her privately and saying, hey, you know, because we don't want to see, it's what I said in the, do you remember, Doug, I sent you there's a great piece that I did with the LA Times last year. And I said, I believe in council culture, not cancel culture. I'm like, I don't want to throw anybody away. I don't want to throw anybody away. But I do think that we know we need to create a space where people can deal with their stuff, you know, and it's like, you know, and one reason why I acknowledge, for example, Women's History Month, and I'm clear that if it wasn't for my single mother and my aunts and all the women who have helped to develop me, I wouldn't be the kind of man I am, because I had to unlearn some things around sexism, around patriarchy, you know what I mean? And the same thing applies to racism, but people have got to be willing to do the work. And so again, I guess you could say with both the original 13 episodes, but also the reunion episodes, it shows how far we've come, but also shows how much work we still need to do.
Yeah. And that was what was profound about it to me, because, you know, Julie, on the other hand, seemed to, well, really everybody, but I single out Julie, because when she was on the show originally, you thought, well, here's the, you know, Southern naive white girl, and her views about race seemed to have evolved a great deal.
I mean, she was the main one talking about we have to be anti-racist. I was like, and then her daughter, I had the wonderful opportunity, yeah, you know, to speak with her daughter, and her daughter is very much about civil rights and human rights. And so, I mean, but, you know, think about it.
Well, that's a direct line back to you probably, Kevin.
I'm sure.
Yeah, but also think about the fact, and I take ownership, but think about how I used the B word on Becky in an original episode. I would never, never call a woman that in 2022. You know what I mean? Right. So I also had to learn how to be a different kind of man. Like, I got to work on my internalized sexism. So it applies to all of us. None of us are above growing, I guess, is the ultimate point of the reunion episodes that Jenny's bringing up. But we got to be willing to grow. That's the key thing. And I think that someone's attacking us or trying to do something to us. Honestly, I want to see a world where, you know, we are not freaking racist and sexist and homophobic and transphobic and anti-Semitic and dropping bombs on people in the Ukraine. I mean, it's insane, the stuff that we have to deal with. You know what I'm saying?
It is. Yeah. It is. When you left the real world, I know you were writing for Vibe already. And I think you already mentioned this. You like worked for MTV for a minute there, right? On a project?
Yeah, with Lauren Lazen. Shout out to Lauren Lazen, you know, and Rob Fox, our rest in peace, our brother Rob Fox. It was, you know, a documentary called Straight from the Hood. And so the wonderful thing about MTV, you know, at that time especially, is that if you were a young person, a young-ish person, you could literally learn how to write, you know, edit, produce, direct, all kinds of stuff. It was really this kind of fertile space. And the same thing with Vibe. I mean, they gave me a lot of opportunities. And I mean, little did I know that, you know, Tupac Shakur would become Tupac Shakur. And all these years later, I'd be working on a 400-page biography of him as we speak right now.
Tell us a little bit about your relationship with Tupac. You wrote, I think, several cover stories for Vibe, right? At the height of his career. Tell me about how you guys connected and, you know, and what brought you together.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when Quincy Jones pushed for the first issue of Vibe that had Treacher on the cover, that sold out completely. And so we got the green light from Time Inc. to go ahead. And we had our first staff meeting. And at the time, if y'all remember, Dr. Dre and Snoop had blown up with the Chronic album. Because remember, Nothing But a G Thing was one of the top videos on MTV at that time. And so they were like, Kevin, you know, who do you want to write about? I was like, there's this guy named Tupac Shakur. I know a lot of people have never heard of him, you know, but I had a stack of articles and research on him. They're like, that's nice, but can you do the story on Snoop Dogg? I was like, okay. And so I did the Snoop Dogg cover story. As fate would have it, I was sent to Atlanta, Georgia, to the Jack the Rapper Music Conference, where Snoop Dogg was, and literally stumbled into Tupac. He was in the lobby. There was a bunch of folks around him. And one of my staff co-workers at Vibe Magazine, Carla Radford, it was bold. She went up to Tupac and said, hey, you need to know Kevin Powell. And Tupac spins around and says, oh, my God, I watched you on that show. I had your back on that show. Da da da. So here I was, a fan of Tupac's. Little did I know, because of the real world, he was a fan of mine. And to Doug's point, I ended up doing 3 cover stories of him, including a famous prison interview. And I was actually in Vegas when he died. And that ended up being a cover story for Rolling Stone. And as I said, all these years later, here I am now working on a biography about Tupac Shakur. It literally started like that. It just, that introduction. And I don't think if I hadn't been on TV, if he hadn't been in the movie Juice, that it would have happened, honestly.
Jen, you got anything you want to get at before we let Kevin go?
We're wondering, what is your favorite basic cable show of all time?
You know, I tell you who I miss. The CNN Countess basic cable. Was that basic cable?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I miss Anthony Bourdain so much. Mm. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Because I thought he was classic New Yorker, classic Northeast person, New York, New Jersey personality. And I just, you know, he represented to me what we need in the world, which is someone who's not afraid to go and experience other people's cultures. I love that about him.
Well, that's a great answer.
That's a great answer.
Yeah, that is. I think we all miss Anthony Bourdain. And I think you're the first person to bring that up. I'm actually surprised we haven't heard that more so far.
Yeah.
So just going to compliment you on a great choice.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I mean, and, you know, I just and I will admit it, like I'm a TV junkie. It's like when I think about it, it's not that far-fetched that I would end up on a TV show because I watch so much TV and I'm one of those saps, yo. Like my partner and I, she and I were watching for the first time in years a few weeks ago, A League of Their Own, you know, directed by Penny Marshall. And I mean, it took me back to Tuesday nights with Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, and Three's Company. I was like, that was great TV. Yeah.
Well, look, man, that was really great. Can't thank you enough.
Love you all. Thank you all.
Thanks, Kevin.
Wow, what a great conversation with Kevin Powell. Such an interesting guy, right?
Yes, he absolutely is. I loved every part of that conversation, but I still cannot get over the fact that there was never an argument between him and Julie where he allegedly picked up a candle holder and all that stuff, that it was just manufactured. I thought all reality TV was real. Come on.
Well, wait, so do we think that she made it up or the producers sort of?
No, I mean, my takeaway was that the producers said, here's a scenario, now have an argument about it. Like that they never had this sort of altercation that led to the other argument. Wow, that was my understanding from what Kevin said.
That's pretty dangerous territory.
It is.
I literally can remember them coming in and telling me they were going to leave certain books, you know, on the coffee table to try and get conversation going. And I literally remember the conversation with the producers where they said, we're going to take him to Jamaica. And I said, well, that's not real life. And they said, well, this isn't real life. This is television. I was like, okay, good point.
Watching those original episodes, it really does take you just right back to 1992. It's so very, very much of that era in aesthetic and what everybody's talking about, listening to. And as Kevin said, that was such a significant year with a lot of things happening.
And kind of notable and maybe a little sad that, you know, he talked about how they were doing this as the LA riots were going on. And then they come to do this reunion special, you know, kind of in the wake of George Floyd. And in some ways, the world's moved forward in a lot of directions. And in a lot of ways, it hasn't.
Exactly.
And they're having the same conversation, you know, 30 years later.
Mm-hmm. That was what was so striking about the reunion of that season of Cast. Because, I mean, it's kind of like... you know, the documentary series, the 7-Up documentary series, where you look at people when they were really young and then you bring them back and see what happened to them. And there's that. But then there's also just, like you said, the moment, the political moment, the current moment is not that terribly different than what it was back then.
And I guess it's easy also, you know, as you look back, you know, particularly for him to sort of put it in context and perspective. But you do get the sense that when it was going on and he was in it, he was thinking harder about it than maybe the rest of the cast members cast members.
Yeah, I think so. I think as he said, he was very, I think, concerned about how to come across as a Black man on television. And then that's totally understandable. And so I think he probably was, for that reason and other reasons, just giving a lot more thought to what was happening.
Very self-aware in all the right ways, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And then he went on to have this, you know, incredible varied career, which I followed now for years. You know, he actually ran for office in New York City a couple of different times and fortunately did not win. Actually, out in Brooklyn, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, all these books that he's written and this great ongoing, you know, almost lifelong relationship with hip hop and Tupac. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like I said, I can't wait to read that book.
I think he's right though. You know, Tupac is one of those artists. You know, this happens a lot, you know, when they pass too quickly, they become immortal in a certain sense.
Yep.
But I do believe, you know, just even, you know, watching my own kids who are much younger than Kevin and did not, I think Tupac was probably already gone by the time they started listening to hip hop, but you know, he's a big artist to them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he is absolutely multi-generational. There's no question about it.
Were you a fan?
I was, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I'm not a fan of, turning him into a hologram. I don't love that.
were you like a fan back in the day? Was that a guy you listened to?
Yeah, I wasn't. I was more into grunge alternative stuff than I was hip hop at that time.
As it turns out, Kevin was as well.
But I did like him as an actor. I liked him in Poetic Justice. I just think he's one of those people that just has natural charisma and presence.
Well, an amazing conversation with Kevin Powell. I hope you all enjoyed it as much as Jen and I did. And we'll look forward to being with you next time on Basic. Basic is a Pantheon Media production in partnership with SiriusXM, hosted by Jen Chaney
and Doug Herzog, produced by Christian Swain and Peter Ferrioli.
Lindley Ehrlich is our assistant producer.
Mixed, mastered, and music by Jerry Danielson.
Edited by Zach Spisner.
You can find Basic on Apple Podcasts, the SiriusXM app, Pandora, Stitcher, or wherever you like to listen. If you like the show, please rate, review, and share so other people can find us. Don't forget to follow the show so you never miss an episode.